My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nice. Listen, this is it. This is the swan song. I want to tell you, don't look so happy. Listen, it really is a great privilege to have been here. I appreciate those individuals who asked me to do this, and I really enjoy doing this. And I want to try to share some things with you on the 12th step that, you know, what I always try to do, what I try to do, or actually don't try to do much, but I don't try too hard, you know. But what I do want to do is maybe share a little something that comes from my heart, which maybe is a little different than what you might hear at some other meetings. You know, I don't know what you hear at other meetings, and I know what I used to say, but, you know, the way I think about the steps are, you know, a little different. And, you know, it's funny, I'll be thinking about, you know, I don't have a script or anything, and I'm really not sure exactly what I'm going to say. There's certain things, I have readings I want to read. And probably when I get off at any particular meeting, I leave the meeting, there's probably a bunch of stuff that I wanted to say that I didn't say, and a bunch of stuff I said that I didn't say, and all that sort of stuff. But, and I'm not sure in any one meeting you can get every possible way of looking at the 12 step into that meeting. But it's sort of strange. It's sort of one of the blessings of being sober and the transformation that you have, I think. I think it's a blessing. You know, people ask me every once in a while, well, you get nervous when you get up here. And I don't. And one of the blessings of the promises is you lose fear of people. And you know, when you're scared, you got to plan a lot. You understand that? Because you don't want to get hurt, and you worry a lot, and you get anxious a lot, and you got to have and when you're scared, you got to have control. You got to make sure you're controlling everything, you know. And I guess there's nothing wrong with planning. There's certain things you have to plan, but there's a there's a freedom in being able to wing it without fear. And I can't explain that to you, but I'm just going to pray that one day everybody in here understands that deal. And then when you understand that deal, you'll say, this must be the deal he was talking about. You'll be up here, or you'll be somewhere, and you'll be winging it. And you'll say, this must be what it's like to fly solo. You know what I mean? It's pretty cool. So, you know, what happens is, I'll be sitting down there, and I got some sort of idea of what's on my mind. And in 10 seconds before I stand up, I think of a whole different deal. And, you know, there's a little voice in my mind that says, well, you can't do that deal. Because you weren't even thinking about that deal. You were thinking about this other deal. But one of the beauties about not being scared to say, hell, go with it. You know what I mean? This is what the Lord puts on your heart. Just go ahead and go with it. So I'm gonna talk about a couple of things having to do with the 12th step. I think it's sort of connected. I think one of the beauties of this thing is to connect the dots. One of the things I like to do, you know, sometimes I like to spell things out, but what I really like to do is just sort of throw crap out there. Just throw stuff out there. You know, and I'm not gonna do the chicken on the roof thing. A lot of you know the chicken on the roof, but one of the things I learned real early on in my third year of doing this stuff is that if there's a couple hundred people in this room or whatever, and I'm talking, you know, the fact of the matter is there's 200 different meetings going on. I mean, if we gave everybody a test in here after the meeting and said, okay, what did he say that you really liked, or you thought you got some out, you thought it was important? I mean, of course, 50 would say he's full of crap, you know, which is okay, but, you know, the 50 that actually would write down something, you know, they'd all write down something different. There'd be different parts. There may be a 45-minute talk, but there would be like a line or a sentence or one thought that somebody would write down that would be different from anybody else's thought. And 80% of those thoughts would be stuff I didn't even say. And 6 months from now, some guy who didn't get anything out of it would be thinking about something. He'd think about something he thought I said because he heard something else in me, and it would connect. It would mean something, and he'd say, and he'd give me credit for it. You know, I mean, so who knows? So now what I realized is, is it really is, the 12 step really is trying to carry the message. And trying to, when you try to carry the, you don't have to carry the message. You know, guys get, how am I going to carry, how am I going to get this guy sober? Well, good luck, you know? All I can do is try. And the only way I can try is through the best meeting I can do tonight. Which may be the lousiest meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's going to be the best one I can do tonight. And you know, if you believe in God, and I believe in God, and I think God and your relationship with God has to do with this whole deal, then you got to believe, you just get up there and you try, that people who are going to get what they're supposed to get are going to get it. They're going to get it, whether they're going to get it now, or 6 years from now, or 10 years from now, they're going to get this thing. So I'm just going to, I got some things I want to read, some stuff I want to talk about. There's some things I want to read out of the big book. It's all sort of connected. You have to trust me on this. To a sort of a topic, a sort of theme, having to do with the 12th step, which may not even seem it has to do with the 12th step, but it is. You know, it may have to do with the spiritual awakening. It has to do with the transformation. You know, it has to do with a lot of things. It has to do with, what did the doctor say? He said, ideas, emotions, and attitudes were the guiding force of these men's lives are suddenly pushed to one side and they become dominated by a whole different set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes. You know, and so here we have this story in the big book. It's called Sold Himself Short. A lot of this stuff I've read throughout this series. And I want to read you this, the end part of this story. It's called He Sold Himself Short. It says this. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced, now I want to point out one thing. This is one of the founders of AA who's writing this. I'm also going to quote Bill Dotson, who's Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, the man on the bed, in something that he heard Bill Wilson say, which was the guiding force of his whole life. And then I'm going to talk about some things Bill Wilson said and Dr. Bob said. And there's a similarity. You know what I found in AA? I found these men who were different, but they were similar. There's something I'm going to talk about tonight called the heart of the tenth leper. It's a little biblical. I'm going to throw that in for you. So, you know, cover your ears now. It has to do with leprosy and lepers and a principle called the heart of the tenth leper, which I've noticed in Alcoholics Anonymous and I've noticed in these stories. And you run into a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some people stay sober and some people don't stay sober. And some people drink and some people don't drink. And some people seem to have something that nobody else has, you know. And you know, every once in a while, once in a blue moon, you run into an individual. I've been blessed to be sponsored by him. That there's just something about him. You know, there's something about him that's different. They don't complain. They don't talk badly about other people. Their life is not a never-ending melodrama of how they feel. They're not involved in anybody else's life except to the extent that they can maybe be constructive or helpful to them. You know, they're not, every time you run into them, there's not a rendition of everything that's happened to them on that day. And all the people they've run into and the problems they have. There's like a different deal going on. And I ran, now that's not, now if you know anything about alcoholism, you hang around the alcoholics and I am an alcoholic. That's not what an active alcoholic looks like. Hell, that's not even what a dry alcoholic looks like. That's another deal. That's somebody who's hit escape velocity. You know what I mean? You know, they've escaped the gravitational pull of this disease. You know, some people get up there in the stratosphere and they're leaving the gravitational pull of planet Alki, but all they really manage to do is get rid of the booze but they're still circling around planet Alpha, sort of like the moon. Sort of stuck in the gravitational pull, sort of thinking that they've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, and they've experienced much of heaven, that new freedom and new happiness. But all they really experienced was that, whatever that happiness was, the guy in Vision for You experienced when he says, feel better, look better, having a better time. See, there's millions of people that come to AA, and for the moment, for the week, for the month, for the year, for the decade, say, hey, feel better, look better, I'm having a better time. The drinking isn't even part of the deal. And it says, we laugh at such salad. These guys who wrote this, he says, we laugh at such salad. We know he'll play the old game again because he's not happy with his sobriety. Now, pretty soon he'll know, you know, desperation, as few men do. He'll wish for the end. And then comes the horseman thing and the whole bit. You know, and so there's a difference. You know, you just see a difference in the quality of emotional and spiritual sobriety. There's many ways of saying it. Bill Wilson talked about after the drinking, when he talks about emotional sobriety, it has to do with unhealthy dependency. We've talked about those. You know, we've talked about those in some of these sessions. So I want to talk a little bit about the heart of the tenth leper and what I see in people that have really taken up this thing and what I really wanted. It says first I'm going to start off with this guy's story. It says this latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am, and over my 8 years I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great. But you know, I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. But above all this stuff I'm talking about, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man. The love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I have been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. Hey, no question what that guy thought was number one in the deal, right? You know, Tozier wrote in the book The Pursuit of God, he says, the man who has God for his treasure has all things in one. Many ordinary treasures may be denied him, or if he is allowed to have them, the enjoyment of them will be so tempered that they will never be necessary to his happiness. Or if he must see them go one after one, he will scarcely feel a sense of loss. For having the source of all things, he has in one all satisfaction, all pleasure, all delight. Whatever he may lose, he has actually lost nothing. For he has it all in the one, and he has it purely, legitimately, and forever. A little bit different than the guy who's always complaining about that he can't get a big screen TV. Or why doesn't he have a better car? A newer car? You ever have to have a car? What's that all about? I'm not putting it down. I know what that's like. And you gotta have something. What does that mean? You have to have a new, you know, I'll tell you something, you know, you just get in that new car, man, I'll tell you, it feels great. Drive off the lot and then it's not new anymore. Then I needed something else. You need a girl. A girl. Good looking girl, you know? But you know, I get them girls and, You know, after I got them, I needed another one. Or a car. Or a new suit of clothes. But, you know, after you put on a new suit of clothes and wear it for a while, you know what it is? It's like it's not new anymore. And then I needed something else. You know, and I needed a better job. But then once you get that job, it's just the job. And then I need more money. But once you get the money, it's only money. I need to lose some weight, you know, and I lost some weight. I did. I lost some weight. But, you know, after I lost some weight, I was just skinny and needed something else. So then, you know, you buy one of these things to Bally's, you know, one of these gyms, because I needed fellowship, or I needed a gym, and I needed something else besides that. And, you know, there's always been, it's never been enough. I've always been left dissatisfied with every single thing I've looked for in my life. Nothing has ever satisfied me. Ever. Nothing has ever satisfied me. The only thing that came closest to satisfy me was the drinking, and that almost destroyed me. And I can't do that deal anymore. Now, here's the deal. If you get nothing else from whatever I'm saying now, I want you to know I'm a satisfied customer. I said, I'm finally a satisfied customer. You know, I've had cancer sober. And, you know, while I was having cancer and going through radiation therapy, you want to know something? In the midst of it, I was a satisfied customer. I was satisfied. You know, I've had problems with my wife and with my kids and sickness. I've had money problems. I've had all sorts of things. And, you know, there's not a thing that's happened in my life that most people would consider problems where during the situation that was going on, I wasn't a satisfied customer. You see, I want to tell you, if you get anything with this, and you know, there's nothing, you don't have to sell this program, but there's nothing that sells a product more than a satisfied customer. These people were satisfied customers. Satisfied customers. There's a line in the Bible, you know, the book that they were reading for the first 4 years. I mean, we've gone over this in Dr. Bob in Good Old Times. It's nothing new. It's nothing heretical. It's just the deal. You know, and it's in the big book. It's in the Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times. They were reading the Bible throughout the entire thing, and they based a lot on it. So there's a story, and it doesn't have to do with what you want to believe or what you don't want to believe, but it's an interesting story, and it's an interesting principle. I see it played out in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's played out in some of the stories. It's played out in the people I see in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I said, I call it the Heart of the Tenth Leper, and it's a story where allegedly the carpenter, the master, you know, was in some town, and they had lepers back then. Now, leprosy was a horrible, progressive, chronic disease. And it was shameful. And they basically ostracized you. So it was a horrible thing. When you think about it, that's basically what alcoholism is. It's chronic. It's progressive. It gets worse. There's no cure for it. You know what I mean? It's shameful. And so they hang out together. They put them in lepers' colonies there. And the way the story goes, it's like this. This is the story. But the story goes is he comes to this village and he sees these 10 lepers and they're crying to him. They're saying, please help us. Because they heard he was going around healing people. So he took pity on them and he prayed for them and he said, you're cured. You're clean. And they looked around and they were cured of the leprosy. And he says, go tell the rabbi. Because if you know anything about what happened in those days, what happened is before you could go back into your old life, before you could go back to the Marlins game, before you could go back and sleep in the big bed, before you could go back into the neighborhood, if you had leprosy, what you had to do, according to the Bible, is you had to go to the rabbi, and the rabbi had to certify you that you were cured. So he said, go back and go to the rabbi. So they go all running off to the rabbi. There's 10 of them, except for one guy. They're all running back. They can't wait to get, you know, not necessarily evil, not bad, nothing wrong. You know what I mean? They didn't do anything wrong. They were actually following instructions. You know, they were actually following instructions. Said, go off to the rabbi. And they're all, one of them saying, man, I can't wait to get back to Sally. I can't wait to see my kids at the football game. You know, I missed, man, I can't wait to get back to my job. Man, I can't wait to play around the golf. They're just running out doing things what people always do. They're not saying I'm going to the bars. They're not saying I'm going to get drunk or gamble. They're saying I want to get back to my life and do what I want to do, what my life was all about. Except for one guy. One guy. The guy, they don't say why. Why it's only one and why it's not three or ten or whatever it is, but it's one guy. This is the story. The story is about this one guy. This one guy stops and turns around and disobeys the direct instruction and goes back. And he gets down on his knees and he says, thank you. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. And so what the line is that's attributed to Jesus, when he looks at him, he looks at the guy, and the guy was a Samaritan. Now, if you know anything about Samaritans, the reason why Samaritans are important is because they were ostracized. They weren't considered chosen, which is something you want to think about, because later on we're going to talk about something that's in the 12th step called the Good Samaritan. Now, I have no idea why the Samaritans, who were supposed to be ostracized, were chosen as people to make a point about. The ones that were considered the worst, the most horrible, the ones that were not chosen, the last, were chosen by this guy to talk about as being an example to the rest. I don't know, but in this case, this man, he looks at him and he says, but we're not ten clean. In other words, cleaned of leprosy. Yet only one returns and gives thanks to God, and that one's an alien. That one's a Samaritan. And then he says, you may go. He says, your faith has made you whole. You see, the other guys were cured of the leprosy. This guy was made, he uses a different word, this guy was made whole. In Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, when Bill Wilson, there was something different about this guy. There was something about this guy that caused him. Everybody was excited to get back to their life and business as usual and get back into the stream of life. And this guy, there was a difference. There was a palpable difference in his attitude and what he thought about it. As excited as he was and as grateful as he was to be cured, he recognized why he was cured, where the cure came from, and he turned around and he went back to give thanks. In Bill Dotson's story, Bill Dotson says the following, Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, on page 191. And he wrote this down because it was so important to him to relate this and what it meant to him. Something he heard from Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson probably said, he was by Bill Wilson's side, sponsored by him, Bill Wilson probably said a gazillion things to him. Just like tonight, if somebody asked you, what did Russell say? You'd say, you know, pick out one. This is the one thing this guy remembers that he put in this book, which he says was the most important thing he ever heard Bill Wilson say. And he heard it when he was 2 weeks sober. And they thought it was so important that this has been in this book ever since. It says, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, a something that I thought a person ought to have. You know that thing I'm talking about. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something that I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of hospital, Bill was over to my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch and I was listening, trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. What was it about Bill Wilson that was different, that gave him this thing, whatever this thing was, that set him apart from the others? He says, Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, and this is in quotes, he said, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling people. You know, I'm not saying that Bill Wilson didn't have money problems and didn't have relationship problems, didn't have the problems that we all have. And I'm not saying I don't have those. I'm not saying you won't have those. But there was something about what happened to Bill Wilson when this disease was lifted from him that was so paramount to everything else that was going on in his life, that no matter how he was afflicted, no matter what he lost, no matter what he had or he didn't have, the overwhelming consideration in his life was that God had somehow chosen him, and he knew it, and was the mover and shaker to lift this disease from him And he was so grateful about it that he was compelled to live his life telling other people about it. He just couldn't even help himself. It wasn't even a matter of choice. He goes on to say, I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden AA, golden text for the AA program and for me. It was that common denominator of having the heart of the 10th leper. And I can't explain it except I know it when I see it. I know it when I see it. Now, I'm not saying when you have 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years, you got it. And I was just as wacky as the next guy, all hand-to-hand combat with the world and all the bullshit that's going on. Really? Really? You know, I need 15 sponsors and a banana to keep me okay. You know what I mean? I mean, really. So I'm not saying you got to be some sort of AA guru, like after 30 days, or you can't be sucking your thumb and going. But I'm telling you, there's something, there's a separation, whether you want to call it the sixth step or something, there's something that happens along the way. Where somewhere, somehow, you get separated out, and you stop bitching and moaning and worrying and fetching and bullshitting about crap and talking like everybody else is talking out there and being focused on what everybody else is focused on out there. And you start focusing your life on that narrow road. You start focusing your life on that one thing, which becomes the number one thing in your life. And to people outside this deal, to the 9 other lepers who are running to the Marlins game, who are going to play golf because that's their whole life is about golf, except that still doesn't satisfy them, or running to that Gallagher, they will never understand that, you know, that guy looks like a fanatic and he scares them. He scares them. They'll never understand that guy. Because he's the man who has God for his treasure and he has all things in one. He's the one that Tozer was talking about. He's the 10th leper that Jesus was talking about. He's the kind of man that Bill Wilson was talking about and Bill Dotson was talking about and Dr. Bob was talking about. These guys like the Mother Teresa's of this world, who when the journalist followed her around all over the place while she was doing her deal, helping people that it probably almost didn't even make a difference. The millions of people, and he finally turned to her and he says, "I wouldn't do what you do for $1 million." And she said, "Neither would I." And he'll never understand that deal. He'll never understand that deal. So let me read you a couple of things. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about how it interfaces in my life and what I notice about my life. Because it also interfaces with the concept of what we talked about last week, selfishness and self-centeredness. There is a difference between a listen, this is not about drinking. This is about whether you're going to be self-centered or God-centered. You know, the man, like that hearted 10th leper, who's on his knees and thanking God, the man like Bill Wilson, who said, "Henrietta, the Lord has been so great to me, lifting me this disease that I have to keep talking about and helping other people." The man's like the Dr. Bobs in this world, and like the Joe Snyders, and like some of my sponsors, like the John Glenns, who's here tonight, he's got like 54 years. The men that I hang around, you know, there's stuff that's important to them, but it's not just not that important. What's important to them is what's important to all. They have the same focus. The focus that I think is the focus of this book. You know, what happens is after a while, I think you come to AA. I really think this is what happens. You come to AA, you read this book, and you try to figure out how to change this book. Or how if you wrote it, you just add or subtract, or how this part applies to you and that part doesn't apply to you. Or you argue with this side or that part. Or you say, well, this can't be, well, you'll adopt this part, but you won't adopt that part. And there are some people that after they've been sober for a while, they sort of wing it on their own. They say, well, the books are nice, all that sort of life, but I've got my program and you've got yours. And nobody can tell me about my program. And we're all individuals. You know what I mean? And they start doing that stuff. But those people, and they may stay sober for 20, but those people never look like Bill Wilson. They never look like these guys. They never look like the man who sold himself. They never look like that. And what happens is, some people, some people, I don't know whether it's 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 110. Some people, as time goes along, they stop looking for the escape clauses in this book. They stop looking for the how they can change this book or how they can sort of make this book fit them. And they start doing something very strange for an alcoholic. Instead of fighting the book, you know, they start, and maybe with a little help from God, sort of pounding them a little. A little pounding, you know, is okay. You know, that's how we get a new perspective. By 100 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, with a little pounding, a little hanging around the room, a little hanging around the right people, they start turning into this book. And the steps stop becoming something they do. It's just something they are. And I can't explain to you what it is when you stop doing the steps and you become the steps. And it doesn't mean you're perfect. You just are the steps. You just are. There's no argument in the book anymore. There's no making fun of people that are talking about the book anymore. You just turn into this book, which is really based upon another book. You just turn into the same book and the same deal that was going on for thousands of years. That's basically the truth. And you just, and all of a sudden you find yourself focused on that deal, and the cars are just not important. Not, hey, listen, I like nice cars. But, you know, I don't understand it. I don't really understand what happened to me. A really screwed me over. I don't even know whether it's a good way or a bad way. I used to have a new car every year. I mean, I had to have one. I beg, borrow, and steal. I am the number one guy to charge stuff or spend stuff or buy things I don't even need and that I couldn't even afford to impress people I don't even like. You know what I mean? I'm like the number one dude. I was like 10 years sober before I realized if you spend money you don't make, you go into something called debt. I didn't understand that. You know, as long as I could drive it off the lot, it didn't matter. I don't know, you know, and I think I have a nice car. I got to have transportation. I got a nice car. I got a Mercedes. It's 8 years old. I got an 8-year-old car. I'm not bragging. To me, that's like bragging if you have an 8-year-old car. I feel sorry for you if you have a new car. You wouldn't even get it. Don't even worry about it. No, but I mean, somebody asked me the other day when I was thinking again, you know, I said, man, I'll drive that thing until it's 25 years old. You know? I just love not having payments, you know what I mean? I just like the car, you know? One day it'll become a classic, I think. I don't know. But you know, when you remove the desire for things from your life, and I'm not saying I'm a totally against, you know, listen, I'm not saying, boy, I'm living on the mountaintop. That's not true. That wouldn't be true. But when that starts going down, desire things, let me tell you something. It removes a whole lot of problems out of your life. You'd be surprised how much you don't worry and you don't fret and you don't envy and you don't feel sorry for yourself. And you don't compare what you have with other people. You'd be surprised how differently you look at life when things are not that important anymore. When people become important. You know, it's really the difference between living a God-centered life and a you-centered life, or a self-centered life. So let me read this real fast, and then I want to end it up and tell you, you know, sort of like a little bit more about what it means. So, and I'm just going to read about 5 or 6 things from the big book. Page 11, Bill's story. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap, there's that scrap heap again, to a level of life better than the best had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was at me in that moment. And this was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past, here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. Later on, it says in the book, My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution to their problems. It was fortunate for my own business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's a design for living that works in rough going. Why would he do that? Why would he go? This is before the big book. This is before. Why would he go down to the hospital? Why would he start thinking about other people? Why wouldn't he do what 99% of the people, I mean they do? Just sit at home, suck your thumb, and feel sorry for yourself. And call up your sponsor and whine. You know, why is it 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 people? Not when they're feeling good, but when they feel like killing themselves. I did this. I'm not taking credit for it. I'm saying this is my good. I don't even understand why I did it. I did it. I don't know. My sponsor made me do it. He taught me to do it. This is what we did whenever you went down there. I eventually started doing it and doing it and doing it. Why do some people, whether they feel bad or good, go to meetings? Whether they have the new car, they don't have the new car, go to meetings. Whether their life is good or shit, they go to meetings. You know, whether they feel like they want to kill themselves or they're feeling lousy, sponsor people anyway. Why do some people do the stuff anyway and try to help people anyway, and other people just fold like a wet newspaper? I don't know why. I know it has something to do with faith in something other than yourself. In understanding that there's something going on there that's bigger than you, that you have faith in, that you know is there, so it never gets that bad where you can't go out and try. I don't know what it is, but it has something to do with that. You know, and apparently this book recognizes it, which is probably why they spend a lot of time talking about it. What seemed at first a flimsy read has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all, it means that all of us, whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of the living Creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing and honest enough to try. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 43 personal experiences. Each individual, in his personal stories, describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's what the stories are supposed to be about. You know, people get upset about people that talk about God and the stories about God and stuff about God. All I know about those people is they have nothing to do with this book. All they have to do with is being pissed off or angry or upset or backbiting or doing all the stuff that this book says that if you really work this thing, it would never occur to you to even open your mouth and say it. It's just another way of drinking. It's just being drunk. Listen, just because you don't have alcohol on your breath doesn't mean you're not drunk. There's a lot of people here who are drunk on envy. There are people drunk on envy. They're going to tell you bad things about other people because they're jealous. And they're all over Alcoholics Anonymous. They're just pissed off because they're jealous. Because they're not getting the attention they deserve. There are childish, jealous, envious, angry people. And they're not sober. But they're picking up medallions anyway. And they got an opinion they want you to know about. Here's the great deal. You have a choice. You can end up like them, or you can end up like Bill Wilson. Or he told me, you got a choice. Everybody's got a choice in here. You know? And you're going to be somebody's example of something somewhere down the road. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find the power by which we could live. Had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how are we going to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book about. Its main object is enabling you to find the power greater than yourself and will solve your problem. That means we've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. It means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him. There's the relationship. Keep close to him and perform his work well. Keep close to him and perform his work well. Not going off running to the rabbi so you can get to the Marlins game. Not getting everything you can get out of this thing so you can start your old life. There are some people that want to get in here, you know why? Because they want to continue to do what they used to do, but without the booze. You know what they want? They haven't changed their minds at all about the way their life is running. They just know that if they get just another car or another husband or another wife or another condo or go on another trip, they just know that this is going to be the one where they're going to have to live in water that satisfies them forever and they'll never thirst. And they're always seemingly disappointed 10 years down the road where they've got everything and then they're drinking again because nothing ever worked for them. Because they turned away from this deal. Because they're not sponsoring people. Because they're not going down to drunk tanks. Because they're not going to AA meetings. Because they're doing what they said to Bill Wilson, what do you think of people that don't drink and don't go to meetings? He says, I have no use for them because they have no gratitude. Because they don't have the heart of the 10th leper. This is a royal priesthood. Hey, let me tell you something. There's many different groups within AA. This is a thumb-sucking crybaby. There's a whole bunch of different groups within this deal. Hey, listen. You only need... The only requirement for membership is a desire to stay sober. That's not necessarily the same thing as being part of the spiritual fellowship. The fellowship of the, you know, there's another fellowship in here. It's called the fellowship of the spirit. It says you will join us in the fellowship of the spirit. There's a lot of people that are members of AA that are not members of the fellowship of the spirit. Not only aren't they members of the fellowship of the spirit, they don't even want to hear about it. They don't even want you to talk about it. They're pissed off when you're at a meeting saying anything about it. Who are you to talk about the fellowship of the spirit? You know? They don't even want to hear the truth that will set them free, that will make them feel good, that will change their life. They're pissed off about it. And unfortunately, because most alcoholics feel so crappy about themselves, thinking at the same time that they think great about themselves, they worry so much about what other people... What that means is when these people start talking, they start saying, well, I don't want to go against them. They won't like me. They worry about that stuff. When Sid took so we had a new employer, being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, this footing, remember he was on a new footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. That's the selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root of our problems, driven by 100 forms of selfishness, fear, and self-delusion. We step on our toes with runs, they retaliate, seemingly without provocation, but we've learned in the past, we've done stuff. But the alcoholics, what does it say? Well, self-override, usually above everything. We've got to get rid of self. We got to get rid of self. We must or it kills us. God makes that possible. That's not me talking. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't like that, you need to take it up with the founders. You need to take it up with it. You need to tell them to stop publishing this thing. Or join another organization. And if you're pissed off, you know what the spiritual axiom says? Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with you. So if I piss you off tonight, you probably owe me $10. It's like a copay. Because I'm like helping you out. Or something, I don't know. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flowing, we enjoyed peace of mind. We discovered we could face life successfully as we became conscious of His presence. We began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. I'm not going to be able to get through all this stuff. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. But this is not an end in of itself. Our real purpose. Here's the real purpose. Here's the real purpose of the guy who sold himself short. Here's the real purpose of Bill Wilson. Here's the real purpose of anybody who has a relationship with God. This is the real purpose. This is the real purpose of somebody who's a member of the priesthood of the world. There's a real purpose of a guy who's got the heart of the... This is how I recognize whether somebody's got the heart of the 10th lever. It says, but this is not an end of itself. Our real purpose in here is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And it says that about 5 times throughout the book. And if you don't read this book and read what Bill Wilson, we still don't know what Bill Wilson did for a living after he came to AA, because all he was doing was helping people and writing stuff. The real purpose, because, and you know why that's our purpose? Because the person that has the spiritual transformation where he changes, it's not even thought of as an obligation. He feels just like Bill Wilson felt. He feels just like I felt. When I read the stuff from Bill Wilson, I know we all identify with the drunk crap. And blah, 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 and then I drank, blah, 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 you know, the jaywalker and all that sort of stuff. But here's the deal. When I read Bill Wilson, I identify with the other stuff. You see, when the reason I read that line, the Lord's been so good to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I got to keep on talking about, and I got to keep on telling people, is I feel like I am Bill Wilson. I'm like channeling Bill Wilson. I know what Bill Wilson was talking about. Because that's the way I feel. That's the way the 10th leper felt. That's the way Bill Dotson felt. That's the way Dr. Bob, that's the way my sponsor felt. It wasn't, he didn't do the 12 step. People that are involved in this thing have realized a spiritual awakening that are on whole new footing, where ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding force of their lives, the cars, the women, the whatever it is, are suddenly changing and dominating. People like that don't do 12 step work. Don't follow principles. Don't do this book because they've got to do it in order to stay sober. They do it because they can't not do it. They can't help but do it. They are compelled to do it because of an overwhelming and an overriding gratitude to God, who they know placed them in a blessed position for this purpose. They understand that. And so a guy like me, and I can't even explain this deal to you, who on Monday is getting in a plane going to California. I'm going to San Francisco. Do this every year with my wife. I'm taking my youngest daughter, 20, San Francisco, staying there for 3 days, driving down to Carmel a couple days, going down to L.A., visit my father for a few days, and flying back. It's a nice trip. I've done it a lot. You know, I'm doing this, okay? As I'm going, and I'm going to go, I'd really rather stay here. I'd really rather be, I can't explain it except tell you, I'd really rather be in a detox center talking to somebody. I'd really rather be doing, as a matter of fact, I've got to forcibly, willfully, sort of tear myself away from this stuff, you know what I mean, in order to do that, because I want to see my father and I want my wife to have a trip and everything. But if you ask me, what I'd rather do is I'd rather just be in an AA meeting. And I can't explain that to you. And I know some people think, well, that's weird. Man, if that's what this is about, I never want what that guy has. Because you're already dreaming of getting out of here, getting to the party. You know what I mean? But what you don't understand is I'm already at the party. Because the people who are involved in this deal are at the 24/7 party. You know, they're at the party that never ends. You know, they're drinking that stuff that you never get thirsty again. You don't wake up worrying about, is this all there is, or where can I get more, or why am I like this, or why is like this, or I can't believe it's happening to me again. You talk differently than other people. They talk differently. They're not complaining, they're not whining, they're not worried about all sorts of details, the crap that's going on in their lives. You know, what do they say, the little things that are going on in their lives. It's a whole different deal. And I would rather have this deal. I did the other deal. See, I did the other deal. This isn't somebody that never did that deal. I did that deal. It's a crummy deal. You want that? You know what the great thing is? You want that deal, you can have it. You can have it. You're free to have that deal. I don't want that deal. I want this deal. This is the deal I want. I'm going to read. I'll save that one for another day. But I'm going to read this one last thing. I've read this before in this group or other groups. I'll read it again. It's a nice little poem I sort of like. It's called The Old Violin. Okay? 'Twas battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding, good folks? He cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? A dollar, now two, only two. $2. And who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three, but no. From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. Then wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up the strings, he played a melody sweet and pure, as sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, what am I bid for the old violin? And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, and $3,000 twice. And going and gone, said he. The people cheered, but some of them cried, we do not quite understand. What changed its worth? The man replied, it was the touch of the master's hand. And many a man and woman, with his life out of tune, and battered and torn with sin, is auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He's going once and going twice. He's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. God bless you, and thank you very much.